Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable panel for this Wednesday, July 30th. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue for a few days this week. He is scheduled to return tomorrow. You can join the conversation by emailing us panel@wamc.org. Please, if you can, keep your letters short, to the point, and on topic. Don't include links or attachments. They become cumbersome to click through and navigate and read while live on the air. And don't use abbreviations. Proofread your emails before you send, if you have a sec. Thank you for listening and for participating in the conversations. The panel this morning, the people we will all be engaging with on air and via email, are Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin. Good morning, Beau.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
I'm all right. We have you here today, and then not for a month. You're going on a big trip.
That's true. We are, my wife and I, and meeting up with our daughter in Europe for a month, and we do an annual hiking trip this time in France and Switzerland and the Alps, so it should be fun.
Should be really fun.
But
and
I'll
come back and let us know what they're thinking over there about everything happening all over
Will
the world.
Do.
Were you going to say something before I prompted you to promote your trip?
Oh, at the risk of embarrassing you and at the risk of being the teacher's pet, it's rare that I get a chance to be across the table from you. So I want to thank you and Madeline for doing a phenomenal job of helping those of us who are new and more experienced. You don't get as much credit as you should on the air, and so I just want to thank you.
Well, that's very nice and unexpected.
I have to bring donuts next time.
You guys. All right. So, you know, as much airtime as you want today, Beau. No, it isn't like that at all, of course, but I do appreciate that. Thank you very much. Very kind of you. Also joined this morning by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, who's pitch hitting for us today. We had a cancellation yesterday. Someone needed the morning off. We are always, as we do not pay you, very, very happy to accommodate any reason for a cancellation. And then, of course, thank you, Teresa, for stepping in as per usual.
Glad to be here. Delighted to be here with such a great group.
And the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin, is here. Hi, Bob.
Hi, good morning. So if anybody's wondering why Joe is off today, today is National Paperback Book Day and National Cheesecake Day. So anybody else has visions of Joe Donahue surrounded by piles of books and a big slice of cheesecake, that's probably what's happening.
Hey, your guess is as good as mine. Yeah. I've been saying all this week, people are like, well, where is Joe? And I'm like, he's doing something fun. He definitely told me what it was. I cannot remember. But good for him. Some privacy, right?
And just one special shout out, if I could, on a very personal note. Tomorrow is my 33rd wedding anniversary. So I just want to do a shout out to my wife, because despite what all of you listeners think, I am not the easiest person to live with. So I deeply, deeply appreciate it. So it's just sending my love to my wife.
Of course. Oh, congratulations, Mazel. 33 years is a great run. I mean, and it's not over yet. So cool.
Well, if she had murdered me back in the day, she'd be out on parole right now.
panel@wamc.org to join the conversation. Let's begin this morning after our this does happen almost every show, right? We're happy to see each other. We're happy to be together. We have a jovial kind of greeting, and then we do need to drop into a very, very serious mode. Post-haste, because the news is not light and cheesecake. We're going to talk about the latest sort of conversations surrounding Gaza, as well as what is happening in Gaza. I will prompt you all into conversation by mentioning the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer is moving closer to recognizing Palestinian statehood. Britain is now actively weighing the recognition of a Palestinian state. Two senior government officials said on Monday, a striking shift prompted by public revulsion at the images of starving children in Gaza and the immense pressure on Prime Minister Keir Starmer from lawmakers in his own Labour Party. Mr. Starmer did not follow President Emmanuel Macron when he announced last week that France would recognize the state of Palestine. The British Prime Minister had said in a statement at that time that recognition had to be part of a wider plan which ultimately results in a two-state solution and lasting security for Palestinians and Israelis. But the British officials who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive internal deliberations said momentum was building because of the escalating humanitarian crisis, with reports of deaths from starvation in Gaza after months of restrictions on aid imposed by Israeli authorities. I'm going to piggyback a couple other things on, because I don't want to just raise this one point and then have us sort of stray into other areas without setting up that also in the here in the States, the admittedly, you know, self-avowed far right Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has castigated fellow MAGA Republican Representative Randy Fine for denying the starvation crisis in Gaza. She also notably joined the small cohort of members of Congress to describe Israel's actions in Gaza as genocide. And this morning, major global news organizations are calling on Israel to lift restrictions on humanitarian aid entering the Gaza Strip and on the movement of reporters in and out of the enclave as Palestinian reporters there struggle to survive amid extreme privation. Internal leaders and humanitarian organizations have sounded alarms about Gaza's rapidly worsening hunger crisis, which has led to dozens of hunger-related deaths this month. Now news organizations, including the New York Times, have begun weighing in, noting that Israel has restricted international reporters from independently entering the enclave during the war and that local reporters are trapped there without enough food to live or work. Bo, would you like to begin?
Sure. And I'll begin with a couple of different things by Sarah by saying, first of all, there's a little irony here. I'm all for what Starmer's doing, but there's a little irony here in light of the fact that part of the major reason we're in the situation we're in, or the Middle East is in the situation it's in, is because of the Balfour Doctrine, where England sort of said, we're going to move Palestinians out and make a homeland for Israelis back in 1917. And so for the UK itself to recognize, to move towards recognition of Palestine or Palestinian state has a little bit of irony to it. That said, I think there are a couple things we've got to keep in mind. And a quick plug, anybody out there who missed Monday's show, is a fascinating roundtable show. It's a fascinating show. Go to WAMC and listen to that conversation, a fascinating conversation. I highly recommend it. I'll suggest a couple things about where we are now. First of all, I think the two-state solution, despite some opposition, the two-state solution is the only remaining solution. I went back to many of you will remember John Kerry's December 28th, 2016, right before Trump entered office his first time. He had what was a remarkable hour-long speech at the State Department about the two-state solution. It was sort of his lasting, this is John Kerry, his and Obama's lasting sort of international moment, and he spoke about the need for a two-state solution. I've been thinking a lot about whether or not there really is an alternative to the two-state solution. And the answer, I think, is unfortunately no. There's lots of steps that need to play out. There needs to be a ceasefire. Hostages need to be exchanged. But negotiations have to focus on a two-state solution. It's not a perfect option, but it's a good enough option if you can make some of the inroads that I think the Obama administration had made with Israel and with the Palestinians. I'm not, you know, at the end of the day, one of the things that problem for me is all the major players who are at the table have short-term self-interest in mind, right? So Netanyahu has short-term self-interest in mind. He's got to keep his coalition together. He's got to keep himself out of jail. We've talked a lot about that on the roundtable. His interest is more short-term, not long-term. Hamas has short-term interest as well, and they just want to survive, at least somewhat intact. They've lost all military capacity, fair enough, but Hamas is trying to survive in Gaza. The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has short-term interest. How do we know that? Because there's so much corruption in the Palestinian Authority. And so what I think Trump and the administration needs to do, Marco Rubio and others, need to do is keep hammering home the long-term goal of stability and peace in the region. And I think the only answer to that is a two-state solution, which I will defer to my fellow panelists, but I'm happy to talk about in more detail.
Go ahead, Teresa.
Go ahead, Teresa.
So I'll defer to you folks on the two-state solution issue. I mean, it seems to me reasonable that there be a two-state solution, but it's a complexity at a level that, you know, I think you have better background than me on it. My concern is the use of starvation as a tool of war. And I think that it's clearly happening. In fact, as a technical matter, according to the experts, the situation has now reached the definition of a famine. But this is not a climate-related famine. This is not a weather-related famine. This is a famine that has occurred because the Israelis are not allowing food into the area at a level that's required to keep people alive. And everybody says, well, what can they do? What can they do? It's very simple. Open the gates. Open the gates and let the humanitarian organizations who know how to deliver food and who are lined up with trucks that are filled with the food and the medicine that's required right now, let them in, give them safe passage, protect them in that passage. And the answer is not airdrops. Airdrops are photo ops. They are extraordinarily expensive, in some cases dangerous, photo ops. The food doesn't get to the people who need it most. First of all, good news that the media has turned their attention to this issue. I think you've really seen, we were on Friday talking about this, and there was not enough attention. And I really think the media, since Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there's been a real shift, and I think that makes a difference. I think this is a time, if our listeners are concerned about this, this is a time when American voices need to be heard about how American dollars are being spent. Because the leverage in this country is Donald Trump. These are our dollars. Get on the phone. But listen to what he's saying. Listen to what he said on Saturday. Listen to what he said yesterday. If you haven't heard his press availability, where he was in Scotland to hype his golf course, but he was also meeting with the president of the European Union, Ursula von der Leyen. And in advance, he was asked for the first time, what do you think about, what do you have to say about what's going on in Gaza? And his first reaction was, well, I gave them $60 million 2 weeks ago, and nobody's thanked me yet. And if you're going to give $60 million, you should be thanked. So good for them. A reporter followed up and said, well, what do you think about the starvation? What's happening? And he said, well, you know, they steal the food. They steal the food, and we can't have people stealing the food. Asked again. He just seemed to have no real... whether he doesn't know, or he knows and doesn't understand, or he doesn't care. I don't know what it is, but it's despicable. And he was asked again yesterday, and, he appears to acknowledge now that there is a food problem. But his solution, the American solution, is to give more money to the existing group. He said he wants to give it to the Israelis to distribute. They are using food as a weapon of war. And when they do distribute it, they only distribute it to certain places, and it appears to be places where they want to move people to. I read and listened to David Miliband, International Rescue Committee. He's the president of that, former Foreign Service Secretary to the United Kingdom. He spoke out yesterday. They do a lot of emergency food relief and talked about how critical it is. What a critical point they are with so many people dying every day of starvation, and that the amount of food that Israel says that they're going to bring in through these 10-hour reprieves where they're going to allow food in is not near what it would require to just stop the dying of starvation. And as was discussed, it's children are dying, but also it's reached the point where doctors don't have enough food. The doctors were trying to save people without the proper medicines. They don't have food. And the reporters who are inside, their companies can't get food to them. I mean, this is a crisis. We're watching it. It needs to be dealt with.
Bob.
you know, let me pull several of the themes that, that Beau and Teresa laid on the table. You know, after the October 7th attack, the concern about the security of Israel was paramount. And I thought at the time Israel acted in accordance with international law and convention and protected themselves. You know, what has happened since then, though, shows us that Israel is more than capable of defending itself. Both the way they handled the war with Hamas, and certainly how they handled the Iranian situation, what they're doing in Damascus, and I lay this out, Sarah, because it becomes becomes an important part of what we need to talk about, is that it's difficult to now look at what's happening in Gaza and not say, okay, it's gone too far. And I agree with Marjorie Taylor Greene, and that's not something that I say lightly or even sardonically. I think she's right, and it bothers me in a couple of different levels. One, having worked with the Israeli government when I was still in the federal government, and knowing the people, and I will tell you that Tel Aviv is one of my favorite cities in the world. What I'm seeing now and the policy I'm seeing out of the Israeli government is so anathema to the people and what the people believe that it's absolutely frightening. And I worry about Israel. I worry that what Israel is doing is, you know, it's a Pyrrhic victory. They may win the military. They are winning the military war, no question in my mind. At the same time, they're losing their soul. And I worry because there's a lot of lessons out of the situation in Gaza that I'm going to bring back here about what happens when a government isn't reflective of the characteristics and morals and values of its people and its country, and what comes next. In other times, I would say that the United States would act sort of as a governor in the situation, and we would do what was morally correct, both supporting Israel's right to exist, supporting their national security, supporting our national security, but doing what was humanitarianly correct. I have no faith in the current government to do that. In fact, I fear that part of the actions in Gaza have more to do about a real estate deal than it does to do what is truly linked to national security or the best interests of the national security of either the United States or Israel. I'll also note, and I know I'm out of time, so I can come back to this, I really worry about the normalization of cruelty in the use of food as a weapon, yes, like Teresa said, and I think we should talk about that.
We'll return to this topic after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LeDuc, in studio with Beau Breslin, Teresa Bourgeois, and Bob Griffin. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Bob, you took us up to the break with something you wanted to discuss. Could you reestablish, and then we'll continue?
Yeah, we're talking about the situation in Gaza, and we were talking about the concerns about both the genocide and the famine that is occurring in Gaza. And there's a couple more issues I'll toss on the table for the panels and for letter writers at home. There's a couple interesting points, things that jumped out at me, like Netanyahu using the term fake media, you know, fake news. Again, now anytime news comes out that a politician doesn't like, it's immediately labeled as fake. There's a huge difference in my mind between fake versus something that you didn't want all of us to know. But again, it's the trend that we've seen in this country, and it's the fact that we have a president now that is destroying free media. So we've got that issue. We have another issue here that we should be talking about, and it's the fact that what were our closest allies in France and the United Kingdom, basically taking a position that is absolutely contrary to where the United States is. And this is a continued fraying of our international partnerships and alliances, which is going to have enormous implications on this country. It also, I think, is frankly a threat that the Israeli government needs to be watching very carefully, because they are losing, I think, some of the global support that they did have. Closer to home, though, and I'm going to toss this, you know, we start to talk about food. You know, Teresa, you're right. I mean, airdrops is not, you can't drop enough food. Okay. We're talking having to bring in, you know, container ships worth of food. And the idea somehow that because Trump didn't get thanked, Donnie, it's not your money. You don't pay any taxes anyway. Okay. It's the United States citizens' money. It's my money and your money that you're paying in taxes, because you pay more than the richest do. I don't need thanks. And people are stealing the food because they're starving and their kids are dying. And there needs to be empathy. But hold on one sec, because this is the point I want to get to. And again, think about the policies of this government, where we actually destroyed food that we had already paid for rather than distribute it to people who need it. What are we doing as a country, and why are people not out in the streets right now in this country saying this is wrong?
I am so glad that you made that point. There was enormous amounts of food that was paid for, and this is emergency food that you give to people when they're starving. And it was in a warehouse, and the Trump administration, you know, this is part of killing off AI, you know, ending USAID. They would not distribute it. So other humanitarian groups said, okay, you won't distribute it. Will you give it to us to distribute? No. They spent $130,000 destroying it. Who does that? This is the U.S. money. This is U.S. food. This is in our name. And why aren't people outraged? I just can't sleep over this. I don't understand why people aren't outraged. And this notion where Trump's first reaction, I mean, you look at these photos of babies, just literal skin and bones, and you read the stories of how many kids are dying and adults are dying every day of starvation, and your first reaction, his first reaction is about himself, not about this situation. Who acts like that? But let me just say, Trump keeps, big picture, I would like to say, as you did, Bob, that you can be for Israel, as I am, and against what the Netanyahu administration is doing. And I think we need to be very clear about this. It is not anti-Semitic to be opposed to a government using food as a weapon of war that's resulting in the starvation of individuals, including children, dying every day. But this notion that Trump says over and over again, he did it a couple times yesterday, they're stealing the food. And by this, he means Hamas, right, is stealing the food, that it's not getting to the people because they're stealing it. In fact, as the New York Times reported, quote, the Israelis' own military determined that, quote, they never found proof that the Palestinian militant group had systematically stolen aid from the United Nations. And other outside groups have said the same thing. Certainly there's loss in any situation like that when you're moving food. But this notion that, well, we can't have them, the humanitarian groups, do it because they're giving the food to Hamas, there's not clear evidence of that. But there is clear evidence. The United Nations issued a statement on July 27th, quote, of the 74 malnutrition-related deaths recorded this year, 63 occurred in July, including 24 children under 5. Many died before reaching medical care, their bodies slowly showing signs of severe wasting. People are slowly dying. The trucks are literally lined up at the gates. The Israelis need to let the trucks in, and not just a handful. They need to start feeding people.
Okay, let me, brava, both of you. Let me respond to a couple of different things that Bob and Teresa have put on the table. One, I the problem is blame belongs on both sides, right? One can rightfully criticize, as Teresa, you just said, rightfully criticize Israel without being anti-Semitic. One can rightfully criticize Hamas without being anti-Palestinian, right? One can rightfully call this a humanitarian tragedy without leaning in one direction or another. It's a moral, human tragedy. One can believe that a two-state solution is the only chance without being naive and thinking there are a whole host of problems. There are a whole host of problems. And one can also believe that pressure from the U.S. and Europe, if intense enough, may make a difference without suggesting that the West or the global North is pulling this sort of colonial white knight crap, right? So, and I'll say a couple of other things. One is, Bob, you're absolutely right, right? Here's the problem with social media in the moment. I don't know if anybody saw Netanyahu respond to, I can't even remember, this was yesterday. He responded to somebody by suggesting that their criticism of his government was essentially a advocacy for Hamas, like you support a terrorist organization. No, you know, that's the problem with Twitter. That's the problem with social media is that, you know, there's this drop the mic sort of mentality. If you make things extreme enough, and this is the Trump effect, if you say it enough, people are start to believe it's true. Fake news is exactly the same way. Like, oh, you say fake news and all of a sudden there's a good portion of American citizens who believe it's fake just because you said it was fake news. Marjorie Taylor Greene, I agree. Bob, I'm with you. I'm shocked to say that I'm on the same page with Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Even a blind squirrel finds an acorn.
That's right. True. There, you know, so.
But we have to applaud her for speaking out.
Yeah.
And
right?
Here's where, Teresa, this is the interesting thing is, how many times has there been those on the far right who are willing to speak out, and usually I'm not with them on the far right, but whether it's about budget, whether it's about the Israeli situation, whether it's about Project 2025 or whatever, you've got this group on the far right that always comes into play. We saw this in the One Big Beautiful Bill. They always come back. The only time they really had any power, this far right group that comes out and fights against Trump, is when they were able to eliminate McCarthy as Speaker of the House. Other than that, they fall in line. So Marjorie Taylor Greene can break with the Trump administration by calling it genocide, and it won't make a difference because when push comes to shove, Marjorie Taylor Greene will, in fact, move back over and give McCarthy
the
majority.
Certainly the outlier situation is the Epstein case, right? And I don't want to, in terms of them not falling in line, that's where they're not falling in line. But I do want to credit her for saying what she's saying. And I think we need more people. And I know that Congressman Tonko and a group of other folks in New York signed a letter to the White House. I want to applaud them for doing that. People need to call the White House, call the State Department. But in the past, I think something that you both alluded to, the French, the Stammer, in the past, the U.S. leadership would build a coalition that included our European allies and addressed this issue, right? So the piece that's missing here is leadership from the U.S. building a coalition of friends of Israel to say, don't do this, right? And that's not happening. And when Trump was asked yesterday, well, did you talk with Starmer about this? You know, where are you on the Palestine? He said, oh, no, it didn't come up. It didn't come up? Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, but that's his answer. It didn't come up. And if it didn't, why not? How could you talk with him and not be discussing this crucial issue about what's going on in the Middle East? Where is the U.S. leadership on this?
You get to talk about his golf courses. I mean,
right.
A couple.
By the way, how much of that trip did the U.S. taxpayers pay, as an aside?
All of it.
It shouldn't have. It was a business trip, just like the Middle East. More than half of it was a business trip. But I digress from this important.
I think these are important points. I mean, because we now have a government that apparently the Monuments Clause doesn't mean anything. And the interrelationship between U.S. foreign policy and what's right for the Trump family is so intertwined. I don't even think I need to lay it out for our listeners. And I do want to put this on the table, though. You know, our government's position right now is in alignment with Israel in the sense that the feeling is, my feeling, this is my opinion, is that we don't believe that the role of government should be to feed our people. I mean, if you look at what happened in the Big Beautiful Bill, if you look at the reductions in SNAP, okay, I mean, we had a majority of members of both the Senate and the House who said that government's role is not to feed starving children, okay? So if you don't believe that this is the role of government, then it's not a stretch to say that the idea of using food as a weapon is anathema, because it fits in completely with sort of the position that this administration has taken.
And don't look now, Bob, you just single-handedly in the last, minute and a half, did a better job than any Democrat I've heard in having a message going into the midterms. And I know we're going to touch upon this down the road. I think we're going to touch upon this, Sarah, the infighting that's happening between the Democratic in the Democratic Party between Booker and others. But one of the problems I've always said, and Bob, you just hit the nail on the head, is the policies themselves suggest a clear message. The Trump administration doesn't want to feed people, right? There's no empathy there. For 90 seconds, you did a better job of giving a Democratic message than anybody else. That's a shame. That should not be that. As much as I respect and admire you, I need the politicians to step up, too.
Well, I'm not a particularly bright guy. There's a lot smarter people than me. It is this normalization of abject cruelty. And right now, as a country, we're celebrating that cruelty, or at least the ruling party right now is celebrating that and pulling the rest of us along.
We're up against a break here. Yep. We'll be back momentarily. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Our panelists this morning, Joseph Palamountain Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Public Policy and Communications Expert Teresa Bourgeois, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. And I would like to share some email from listeners now. This is from Rachel, who says, as a person who is outraged and is attending protests more frequently than ever in my long life, I do find it discouraging to have your pundits bemoaning the fact that people aren't outraged and aren't protesting. I imagine that most of the people in your audience are outraged and doing everything regular people can do to protest this wretched administration. If the thousands of protests aren't getting sufficient media coverage, it may be because they're so prevalent, it's not news anymore.
Apologies, Rachel. I think that's probably right. I think people are outraged. The question is, can the outrage translate into real change? And that's where I'm a little skeptical.
And I guess because I believe in this country, okay, and I believe in my heart about the goodness of what this country represents or could represent. Not that we've ever been perfect. But working to fix those imperfections is part of what our responsibilities are. I guess, Rachel, my problem is I don't understand why more people aren't in the streets. Okay, that's I think my issue, and it's not diminishing the people that are. It's not the people who are bravely standing out every day. My question is, at what point in time do we close this country down to start to show the level of concern that we have about the way things are going?
And I applaud you, Rachel, for getting out there and having your voice heard. But I do not think that the media has properly covered the Gaza starvation situation until the last few days. You hear more and more questions, you know, at White House press availabilities and such. And in fact, I was pleased with the time, our local Times Union here Saturday morning. They put it on the front page, but it hasn't been a front page story. And since May, this has been a slowly building crisis of starvation. And I would venture to guess that the White House has not been flooded with phone calls and emails about their policy on Gaza. I would venture to guess that the congressional offices have not been flooded with emails and phone calls on this one particular issue. And I do think that that does make a difference. And so I do applaud people who are speaking out. But I think this issue of starvation now reaching by definition of famine in Gaza has not gotten the attention. And for reasons are there is so much. But Bob, I do applaud your analysis of this food insecurity, growing food insecurity issue here in the United States. And I think that there is a really dark clouds coming in that regard because of a combination of three things. One is the budget cuts, and the second is the tariffs, which is going to, you know, the food prices are rising, and because of tariffs, they're going to go even higher. And the third is the way in which the immigration crackdown is happening and the reality that our immigrants are a key part of our food system. And so the U.S. is headed toward, I think, we already have food insecurity issues, and they really were exposed a great deal during the COVID, the first years of COVID. But I think that we're headed in a really scary direction in food security in this country.
Diane writes in and says, the cruelty is because this country is being taken and quote unquote ruled as a business and not a country that deals with many issues, one of which can be compassion. The reason why Trump can't relate is one, Trump has no compassion, and two, he treats his employees the same way with absolutely no feelings as a human being. We also heard from Alice, who says, I hope that before you move on to another subject, you caught us, Alice, can you please explain how a two-state solution could possibly work? How can 500,000 illegal settlers be removed from the West Bank? How will the border lines of a Palestinian state be drawn with all the road restrictions from settlement to settlement prohibited to Palestinians? There's very little contiguous land to create a separate state. How could it be created and work? I think it's been a fantasy diversion from the beginning, but I'd like to be wrong. And that is from Alice.
Yeah, so there are a whole host of problems, many of which Alice mentions. The idea of going back to the territoriality in 1967 would be problematic. I think there are a host of problems, but I think that you could, if you avoided things like the contiguity, what the Jerusalem is a shared space. If you did things like that, you could move towards a two-state solution. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things that I'll add to Alice's provocative question, and I think right on question, is the decline in support for a two-state solution in Israel, right? So in 2017, numbers were pretty high in terms of general support among Israelis about a two-state solution. Today, only 21% of Israelis believe that Jews and Muslims can live in peaceful coexistence in Israel. Only 27% support the two-state solution. That's as of a few weeks ago. So I actually think the hill is harder to climb, but when I think about, and this is what I mentioned early on, when I think about all the other options, right, a confederacy, the idea of a single state where Israel has to give up its religious statehood, right, its Jewish statehood in order to become a democracy, that's just not going to happen. And so all the other options, I think, are worse than the possibility of a two-state solution, despite the massive hurdles. I think we were closer in the I know we were closer to a two-state solution earlier in the 21st century, and I just think we need to move I think a lot of people believe we need to move closer and closer to where we were back in the Obama administration.
But I think, you know, what happened on October 7th was I think think that part of the purpose of that attack was both to undermine a two-state solution, but also to undermine regional recognition by the Saudi government of Israel, which would have fundamentally changed diplomacy in the Mideast. I think there are a couple of models we could think about, and the letter writer is spot on. This is a really difficult situation. I mean, there isn't a lot of land. In order to create a two-state solution, you would have to stop expansion of Israelis into the West Bank. You would have to talk about ceding land that would currently be in Israel, in places like potentially Bethlehem, certainly Gaza. But there are models we could think about. Okay, if you think about what's happened in Northern Ireland, maybe there's some lessons there that we could think about as far as the relationship between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. There's also some guarantees that I think would have to be put in place about the sovereignty and the international support for both states. Okay, in order to do it, you just can't put people into abject poverty and famine and expect a state to succeed.
Right.
Okay, that's not going to work. You have to have opportunities. You're going to have some hard negotiations on things like port access, on trade deals. The same sort of you can't put tariffs on a developing country. Okay, so you think about all of the things that we could do in order to help support that and endorse that, and those are our elements. But it will take a lot of time, and part of the situation. And again, I hearken back to the North Ireland example. Hate takes generations to die, and every time people are put through the type of cruelty that we're seeing in Gaza at this point now, that is going to extend. It's going to extend the hate. I think this is a really important point that, you know, one of the things that folks that I really respected when I worked with them in Israel noted to me is that they felt, and this was around the 2014 period, the two state solution was the only solution because of the birth rates of the Israelis versus the non-Israelis was so much higher that a democracy wasn't going to work because they would lose they would lose the vote, and that the two state solution would allow Israel to remain Israel. And the Palestinian state to develop.
But Bob, can we go back to you if you could speak again to the issue of this being viewed as a real estate transaction? Because it seems that the far right, the Netanyahu and his far right aspects of his government, along with Trump, see this as a land issue as opposed to an issue of cultures and people and how they can work together. I mean, they're trying to drive the population out, right?
Yeah, I guess, and it's a little bit more nuanced than that, but it's thank you for the question, Teresa. I'm not sure that Netanyahu views the Gaza situation as a land issue as much as it's viewed as both a national security issue, but for Netanyahu himself, it's viewed as a way of remaining in power. And to me, the specter that
but always, driving the people out as a means of way.
Right. But the continued conflict actually plays to Netanyahu's need to stay in power to stay out of jail. All right. It's Trump himself who introduced this idea of Gaza as a land deal. And this is a problem that I don't think we talk about enough in this country is government shouldn't operate like business.
Panel at WAMC.org to join the conversation. Bo Breslin, Teresa Bourgeois, and Bob Griffin in studio this morning. We'll return after news with Ray Graff. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel. I'm Sarah LaDuke, in for Joe Donahue, joined by Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Public Policy and Communications Expert Teresa Bourgeois, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin. You can join the conversation by emailing us, panel@wamc.org. Let us now discuss Emil Bovee, who misled lawmakers in his confirmation hearings for a federal judgeship when he denied targeting prosecutors who refused to go along with his dismissal of corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams, according to a whistleblower's documentation of a tense staff meeting. The whistleblower came forward earlier this week. Was that Sunday or Monday? Was it Sunday or Monday? Time is tricky.
It's Sunday.
At the virtual meeting in February, Bovee warned public corruption lawyers of the need to follow the chain of command in the Adams case, suggesting promotions for lawyers who helped him dismiss the charges and consequences for those who didn't.
It's a prime example of public corruption.
According to the documentation and two other people familiar with it who spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss materials that have not been made public, the Washington Post reviewed the evidence and withheld more details to protect the whistleblower's identity. Bovee, a former defense attorney for President Donald Trump and current top Justice Department official, was nominated by the president in June for a lifetime seat on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. He was asked several times by Democratic lawmakers in a contentious confirmation hearing last month whether he ever suggested he would treat prosecutors differently depending on whether they agreed to back the dismissal of the case. Beau.
Sarah, I think this is a much bigger story than I think the press is paying attention to. And they've done a pretty good job, but I think it's a big story for a couple of different reasons. So Bovee represents the new jurist in Trump's mind, the one who's loyal not to a particular constitutional theory, constitutional interpretation, not even loyal to a particular ideology, but rather someone who's loyal to the one who's nominating him, the president of the United States. And I think there are all sorts of problems about this. So historically, we've been down this road before. Let us not forget that when Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, stepped down, LBJ attempted to elevate his personal lawyer, Abe Fortas, to the who was an associate justice on the Supreme Court, to the chief justiceship, and the Senate rightfully rejected that, and Fortas ends up leaving the court. Now we have Bovee, who is Trump's personal lawyer, being elevated not to the Supreme Court, but to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals is a very important court, and the Senate didn't even acknowledge or pay attention to the fact that he was Trump's personal lawyer. They paid attention to some of the other things, presumably the Democrats did. But on the whole, we're in a situation where Trump's personal lawyer gets to be arguably one of the, there are only 180 or so circuit court judges out there. That's a pretty powerful position. I'll say a couple of other things. My problem with this moment, with this particular appointment and confirmation by the Senate, are a couple. So there was a time during the early period of American history in which the nomination process was a little bit more objective and a little bit more based on experience and wisdom. So the nomination process has changed. The nomination process for federal court judges, I should say, has changed. We have a couple of different folks to that are responsible. I won't say blame it on, because the NAACP is the most famous organization to realize that courts can make a difference in terms of moving the agenda, right? They did it in Brown versus Board of Education. Mm-hmm. I will say on the air, the greatest Supreme Court opinion of all times. It didn't make a difference on the ground, but it was a moral, high ground moment for the court. The NAACP chose to go through the courts because they believed the courts would defend their minority views in a way that the regular elected officers were officials would not. Nowadays, all that matters in a Supreme Court opinion, especially, but a Supreme Court nomination, especially, but also Court of Appeals position, is whether or not you're going to be able to move a particular ideological agenda. So it matters who's on these courts. Bovey is a one step removed from that because he has no ideology. He has no particular political view. He's just going to do the will of Trump. So I'm fine with the politics of confirmation process at the Supreme Court and at the Court of Appeals level, because that's just the nature of it. That's why we get people like, you know, like William Brennan on the left and Sam Alito or Antonin Scalia on the right. I'm fine with that. What I'm not fine with is that the idea that nominations and confirmations are now solely going to be based on whether or not these people are loyal to Trump. And I'll say one more thing. Part of the problem here is Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell, because when Harry Reid in 2013 decided to filibuster proof or sidestep the filibuster for Court of Appeals appointments, because the Republicans were holding him up, all you needed is 51 votes. What you get is the Boveys of the world when that happens. And then Mitch McConnell moved it up to the nuclear option to the Supreme Court, and you get Amy Coney Barrett, but not Merrick Garland. So this whole Bovey, I'll finish here, this whole Bovey nomination says something about the nomination process. It's going to say something about the future appointments that Trump is going to make in the next 3.5 years. It's going to say something about the future, the next generation of judicial decision making. And that scares me.
Let me add to this a letter from Bill. I think it's a reasonable point to add to the conversation. Bovey's appointment to the federal court is a first step to getting him on the Supreme Court and giving Trump his fifth, this is Bill's word, toady on the court and breaking down the final constitutional guard against his autocratic goals. And Mitch asks, is there a precedent for someone being appointed by the Senate to a lifetime post in a federal appeals court without ever having practiced as a judge? I guess the first question is, has Emil Bovey ever practiced as a judge at any level of the judiciary?
No.
He's an attorney.
And there is precedent.
Isn't Cannon precedent as well?
Yeah.
I mean, Eileen Cannon?
Okay.
Yeah. But there are a couple other issues here that let's toss on the table, too. The Adams case is really dirty.
Yes.
Okay. And let's not lose sight of what the foundational case is here. You know, not just that Bovey was Trump's attorney. Okay. But they cut a dirty deal over corruption. Okay. It was a corruption case. And the professional prosecutors, many of them resigned in protest over this deal. So let's not lose sight of the fact that Trump's dirty, Bovey's dirty, Adams is dirty. Okay, and again, it leads me to a complete distrust of both the government systems, and the court systems right now, because you look at a situation like this and say, this is, you know, it's justice for thee, not for me.
Yeah,
and I don't want to lose sight of that fact. I mean, the only thing that heartens me, and I think Bovey on the Supreme Court, it would be an absolute, you know, disgrace. Is it going to be worse than Clarence R.V. Thompson?
Thomas, or
Alito? Maybe one of the two of them.
Yes.
Maybe
yes.
One of the two of them will go. I mean,
because ultimately those people, you know, I have no confidence in Alito and Thomas, but those people have a political ideology, a mm-hmm. judicial ideology. You can sort of know where they're coming from on any particular opinion, whether it's originalism or whatever. I'm not sure Bovey has any judicial theory or any judicial knowledge. And Bob, just to reiterate what you're saying, let's not lose sight of the Adams corruption situation. that is even more problematic in light of the fact that the litmus test for getting these judicial appointments is whether or not you're willing to go along with whatever Donald Trump wants.
But just remember this one line, everybody. Roe is settled law. How many confirmation hearings did we hear that?
Yeah.
So even, you know, I agree with you, but even, you know, even if you say that he doesn't have one, he does have one. He's just not showing it. And honestly, in order to get through the confirmation process right now, it's become such kabuki theater that I have very little faith in it.
So I think we cannot lose sight of the fact that he was among those who led the Justice Department's so-called weaponization working group. And this is a group of people who were tasked with examining both current and former prosecutors and FBI employees who, and I'm quoting here, quote, actively participated in what President Trump appropriately described as a grave national injustice by, of all things, investigating January 6th U.S. Capitol riot.
Mm-hmm.
So he was among those who led the effort to go after Justice Department employees who went after the people who attacked the core principles of our democracy. And now this guy is on a trajectory to be on the Supreme Court, a person who went after those who tried to protect our fundamentals of our democracy. And the Republicans in the Senate could not muster enough votes to block this guy from being on that pathway. Where are the Republicans in the Senate?
Well,
is there no concern for the core of our democracy? And this is just one more sign of the attack on our judicial system. None of this is normal, folks. It is not normal to have the president's personal lawyer, on a trajectory to be on the Supreme Court when he has no background to get there, when colleagues all over the country wrote yes, there was a very important whistleblower, but there was also many, many colleagues, professionals who said he had no business getting into this position. Just like there are so many norms being broken about how the Justice Department is being run right now.
Mm-hmm.
It is not normal what's happening. It's not normal the way the Epstein case is being handled. It is not normal the verbal attacks on judges coming from the White House and from the Trump appointees. None of this is normal, folks. It's a problem.
Let's connect a couple of things, Teresa. You're absolutely right. Let's connect a couple of things. One of the reasons why it's not normal is because the Supreme Court has given the executive branch the authority to use the DOJ mm-hmm. in the Trump case now 2 years ago, year and a half ago. The DOJ has given the executive branch the authority to use the DOJ for a lot of sort of personal politics. The other thing I'll mention, which I think is you mentioned where are senators? Teresa, you said where are Republican senators? I totally agree. This reminds me of the Saturday Night Massacre, back when Nixon needed to fire folks, first Archibald Cox and eventually Richardson, right? He had to fire these folks because they were independent counsels investigating Watergate. Who was the one ultimately, Archibald Cox and others chose refused the mandate by Nixon to fire the independent counsel. Who was the one who eventually third in line who did fire the independent counsel in the Watergate investigation?
Bork.
It was Robert Bork,
mm-hmm.
right? And the Senate, when Bork comes up to be Supreme Court nominated for Supreme Court justice, the Senate, led by Joe Biden, had the integrity and the courage to turn him down, to make it so that he eliminated his name from consideration. Those days are over, right? Those days of integrity on the part of Senate in the confirmation process are over. And I'm curious when the next Supreme Court vacancy comes up, and Bove is the next one up there, whether or not a Republican Senate will have the integrity that the Democratic Senate had, Democratic-led Senate had when Bork came up.
No, of course not. Look at the game that's being played right now. And I get so tired of the pro-clutching from Murkowski and Collins. Yeah. All they're doing is counting the votes. They know that they've got enough votes so that they can vote against it and go back to Maine and Alaska and pretend like they're independent. That's bullcrap. They're not. And if they didn't have the votes, they would have voted. So it's nothing but theater going on right now. One thing that I will grudgingly compliment the GOP on is they know how to use a slim majority and get every ounce of benefit from that.
That's true.
I don't know if we're going to get a chance to talk about the whole Cory Booker situation. I would rather see public argument among senators of the same party than this game of, okay, Lisa, you vote against it this time, and next bill that comes up, I'll vote against it because we know we've got a majority.
Right. The January 6th case is different, Bo. And, you know, you said, well, it's that there's long past the time where you can expect these folks to stand up. I think if you're a U.S. senator and you can't stand up against somebody who went after the prosecutors who did the hard work of and legitimate, you know, going through the hard work of going after people who attacked our Capitol and put all of those Republicans and Democrats and their staffs at risk. I mean, that's a line that should not be crossed. I think we cannot normalize that. We can't say, well, that's how it is now.
I think you and I and Bob and Sarah agree, Teresa, on this. I think about Rachel, the letter writer earlier on, who said, I'm screaming. The Trump administration is not listening, and the Trump administration and its Senate sycophants, the Republicans in the Senate and the House of Representatives, for that matter, do not believe January 6th is the watershed moment, is a red line. And so,
well, because they did the day after, and they did the day after that, and they did the day after
today?
That, and then they stopped because they're afraid of Trump and they're afraid of his money. But they need to be on the side of democracy. We'll see what happens in North Carolina. Now you have Roy Cooper. Right. Running for Senate, and the Tillis seat is up for grabs. What are the people going to do? What are they going to say about this? Are they going to put in another Republican? Are they going to say, no, we're going to put in Roy Cooper? I mean, we will see in 2 years, but we need to hold these people accountable now. I know there are other important issues we want to get to.
I just want to toss this out, though, and I find this somewhat ironic from my own perspective, is that the only person in Congress and the GOP that I actually have a little bit of respect for, and I can't stand his positions, is Tom Massie.
Yeah.
He's been consistent. I hate a lot of what he says, but you know something? He has been true
consistent
to what he believes.
Yes.
Rand Paul hasn't done that. Certainly McConnell hasn't done that. Cotton hasn't done that. You just look at it and I don't understand. At what point in time do these huge egos start to push back against the fact that they've been turned into very small people by Trump?
So it'll be fascinating thinking about or watching the midterm election. If the Democrats don't win 30 more seats, which I have my doubts now. I think there was a time when I thought that they would shift 30 seats. If they don't win 30 seats, that in and of itself says, Teresa, January 6th doesn't matter. What Trump says doesn't matter to most Americans, right? To those people in this room and to a lot of the listeners out there, it does matter. But at the end of the day, there is no reason why the Democrats shouldn't comfortably take back the House. And today, I have my doubts.
You cannot say you're on the side of police and agree with those, you know, pardons. You cannot say you're on the side of police and agree with those who gone after those who prosecuted those who beat up police officers.
There's a lot of logic holes in what they say and support.
We cannot stop talking about that.
But think of just north of here. Stefanik did the same thing.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, it within our own backyard, we have somebody who says that she's pro-police and voted against has taken a position against those officers who were attacked.
And how many Republicans in New York State, right, members of Congress in New York State did the same thing as she did? You're absolutely mm-hmm. right. But I look to see how some of the key police officers who've been outspoken about January 6th and then they, you know, they were deeply offended by this appointment because they see the connection. They see the connection to this person who spent his time and energy going after people who protected them, their interests. Right.
But Teresa, even the police, you go back for a second.
The police union
itself endorsed Trump over the attacks on members of their own body. Think about how warped that is.
It is warped.
It is warped.
Lillian emails panel at WAMC.org with a question she didn't pose in an unfair amount of time, but I am reading to you in an unfair amount of time before the next break. So do we still have a government? And if we do, what is it? We've lost the executive branch, Congress. Now we're losing the courts. Give me some hope before I go looking for another country. And that's from Lillian. 2 minutes.
The ideals of this country are strong. They're still good. It's not perfect, but it's something that we can hold on to. And we have to go in. We have to clean out the rot. And there's an awful lot of rot that needs to be cleaned out. And there are entire agencies that need to be put down because they're feral. And I'll include ICE and others in that conversation. But as a country, we can do it.
And your voice is your vote.
Yeah. And I would say, although I disagree with much of what happens in Washington, the fact that we can sit around this table, the four of us sit around this table and say whatever we like, suggests that there is strength in the freedom and liberty in the United States, and that's not something to take for granted. The reality is, in many other countries in the world, if we said what we said, we'd be in much more trouble than we currently are.
And the fact that she has a right to protest, to speak up, that everybody listening who engages, Rachel, others, they still have a right to speak up. It's still our country. We just have to, part of being a democracy is to actually use the freedoms that you have to stand up for what you believe in.
And when Bo gets audited by the IRS,
we'll tell you about it on WAMC.
The five IRS agents who are left, right?
I'm going to say Bob goaded me.
It's Sarah's fault.
Yeah, sure. Blame me. Panel at
WAMC.org.
Panel at WAMC.org. Bo Breslin, Teresa Bourgeois, and Bob Griffin are the panel this morning. We will return. I think we will get to two or three more topics in the last part of the show after this news break from the BBC. You're listening to The Roundtable. Welcome back to The Roundtable panel. In studio this morning with Bo Breslin, Teresa Bourgeois, and Bob Griffin, I am Sarah LeDuc. You can email us and potentially get your comments right on the air. Panel at WAMC.org. This news from the New York Times about the EPA, big drawback and challenge to climate change science. Lee Zeldin, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, said yesterday that the Trump administration would revoke the scientific determination that underpins the government's legal authority to combat climate change. Speaking at a truck dealership in Indianapolis, Mr. Zeldin said the EPA planned to rescind the 2009 declaration known as the Endangerment Finding, which concluded that planet-warming greenhouse gases pose a threat to the public. The Obama and Biden administrations used that 2009 determination to set strict limits on greenhouse gas emissions from cars, power plants, and other industrial sources of pollution. Without the endangerment finding, the EPA will be left with no authority under the Clean Air Act to regulate the greenhouse gas emissions that are accumulating in the atmosphere from the burning of fossil fuels. The proposal is President Trump's most consequential step yet to derail federal climate efforts. It marks a notable shift in the administration's position from one that had downplayed the threat of global warming to one that essentially flatly denies the overwhelming scientific evidence of climate change. Bob.
So another step in Project 2025. And you're reading the intro, and all I could think of was the truck dealership before called Four Seasons. thinking about that great moment with
that
Giuliani
center
at the landscaping facility. You know, this is disturbing on multiple different levels. I think it continues to show the lack of moral fortitude in Lee Zeldin, and we should all remember that when Lee comes back home to New York, what he is doing to us. The idea of denying the science is hugely problematic to me to begin with. Because I think there's enough good science out there that has proven the causal relationship between greenhouse emissions, air quality, public health, and certainly the negative impact it has on all of us. By taking out this cornerstone of science, it basically removes the ability of the EPA to enforce the greenhouse gas laws. So in one fell swoop, and again, this is Project 2025, one fell swoop, they have basically killed the ability of the government to go in and enforce something as simple as we have to have clean air and clean water. I mean, so the effects are devastating on multiple different levels. And I can tell you that industry itself is not going to do what is right. Because what if you think about the dumping that was going on, if you think about the illegal dumping of chemicals into our water systems, to the point where, you know, the country forgets, we literally had rivers that were on fire because they were so polluted by chemical dumping because it was cheaper for industry to dump than it was to deal with the situation. This is what we're going back to.
Cuyahoga River in Ohio. True fact, as opposed to a false fact.
The pictures of it are fascinating. For those that are too young to remember, please look that up. That's what this country was doing.
So I think this is Bob's right as usual. I think this, you know, it seems to me, Sarah, that this is a bigger shift in the climate crisis than anything before in the Trump administration. And certainly this is as big of a deal as any climate policy change we've had in the 21st century. So I hope that the media pays more attention to this than just a day or two and then it starts to fade away. There's going to be a 45-day period in which the public can respond. I encourage all of us to respond to that. And then ultimately the policy will go into play. I don't think it will survive the litigation, the inevitable litigation from organizations and probably states too. But between now and then, this is just the Project 2025 playbook, as Bob said. Let me say a couple of other things that I think are interesting. Why we have the endangerment finding in the first place is because back in 2007, there was a important Supreme Court case, Massachusetts versus EPA, that was a narrow 5-4 decision back in the day when you could have a Supreme Court that had 5 liberal votes. The opinion was written by Stevens, and he was the opinion allowed the for the first time allowed the EPA to define greenhouse gas emissions as harmful to human life. The Supreme Court gave the EPA that opportunity, and of course, the Obama administration jumped at the possibility. And so, 2009, the endangerment finding is made action or policy by the Obama administration. I cannot guarantee that the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 conservative opinion, 6-3 conservative majority, would agree with that finding, despite, as Bob correctly points out, the increasing number of scientific facts that suggest that greenhouse gas emissions are, in fact, harmful to human health. But I don't think the Supreme Court is going to uphold it in the same way that the Stevens slight liberal majority in 2007 was willing to say the EPA can regulate this sort of stuff. So I think you have a judicial fight on our hands. The last thing I'll say is, look, in the course of an hour and a half now, we've talked about three major issues that should get Rachel and her friends and others to stand up and shout on the corner, right? The genocide in Gaza, the corruption in the judicial nomination process, and now the climate crisis is being ignored. One of the problems we face in America is the fact that there is always something to protest, and they're all major issues. And so it makes it hard for the Democratic Party in particular to fight the good fight when people have particular interests on one side or another. That's why I regularly say on this station that the Democrats need to come up with a leader and they need to come up with a better message, because there are fights that are worthy of screaming on the top of on the corner. There are fights in all sorts of areas. And until the Democrats get their act together, I think we're in trouble.
I feel compelled to respond to that, but I'm going to let it go.
I'm a good Democrat, Teresa. I just don't see the leadership out there.
I think that there are a range of voices, and I think that one single voice will emerge, but I don't think it's contingent on having just one person. I do think part of the problem now is we are in very different times than we had been previously. I'm not a historian. Y'all would know better than me. But there are just issues in so many different directions where norms are being broken, and so it is hard to stay focused. But let's on this issue, for the EPA issue for a moment, and on climate change. Let me begin by talking about what happened on July 25th in China. The president of the European Union, Ursula von der Leyen, who's come up a few times today, she was in China, and they were marking 50 years of diplomacy between the EU and China. And what was the primary issue of focus in agreement? She talked about the fact that they disagreed on many things, but on climate change, there was a common agreement that they needed to work together. And there's, with every challenge, there is opportunity. And in the addressing climate change, there's enormous opportunities for economic viability, for innovation, for those kinds of things. But you have to stay focused on it. So I raise that to point out that the rest of the world is not abandoning the notion that climate change is real. Why? Because climate change is real, right? And the science is there. And so the U.S. can step back on this, but it's a loss of global, our role in the, not only in our country, preparing us for the resilience that's needed and for the opportunities that are available if you invest in research and innovation and start addressing these issues. The rest of the world will move on. We do this at our own economic and personal peril. I think it's also important to remember the billion-dollar fundraising meeting, but that Trump, yes, this is Project 2025, but it's also a payoff by Trump to the oil and gas, the fossil fuel folks, right, who he said, you know, raise $1 billion and I'll do whatever you want me to do. And so we're seeing the implications of that. The other thing is this raises really serious concerns for the auto industry, because the auto industry had gotten behind the issue of shifting to electric cars, and they invested quite a bit of money in doing that. And the combination of the tariffs, which are really, this agreement with Great Britain, the one, you know, with Stalmer and Great Britain, with Japan, is really hurting our auto industry. I'm sorry, it's with Japan is hurting our industry. But also some of these other tariffs and the fact that there's not agreements between U.S., Mexico, and Canada is hurting the auto industry. And why is that an issue? And also the reduction in subsidies, the clean energy subsidies, because our auto industry was rightfully moving toward electric cars. And now they have had, there's a real disruption in this effort that's costing them billions of dollars.
Well, in U.S. cars that aren't built to a global standard for air pollution aren't going to sell. So right. All the tariffs in the world aren't going to help.
Right.
I'd also note, you know, for folks that think that, that this isn't a story, I mean, just think about the air quality in places like Los Angeles, right, where before these rules were put in place, there were days that you couldn't see walking down the street. Okay, and think about breathing that in. And this is where a nexus of really bad policies, I think, really worry me about what the future is. You're weakening your or eliminating the control over air pollution. Okay, so industry is going to be allowed to pollute as much as it wants because it's a maximization of profit. At the same time, we're kicking off 14 million people from basic health benefits.
Right.
All right. So you start to see these nexus, and then in 20 years we're going to be saying, why are so many people dying of cancer? Why are kids developmentally disabled? Why are we having these societal problems? It all comes back to these policies now that will have enormous implications, not so much on the old rich people who are passing it, but certainly on the kids of today and their kids.
But can I
let me ask you this question, Bob. As the resident expert here on security, broadly understood, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a greater threat to long-term security globally and in the United States than the climate problem, the climate crisis?
I think, besides the fact that there are a bunch of nutcases running governments right now, I think the climate crisis is probably the most misunderstood, but most significant existential crisis that humankind faces.
It impacts immigration. The flow of people around the world will be impacted by it. There's an enormous cost for ignoring it. Look at what the cost of all these storms are lately, right? It's not that climate...
The cost that the federal government is no longer going to help
absorb,
with.
Right? Yeah. And it's not that the storms are caused by it, but the storms are fueled by it. They're bigger, they're worse, they're longer, they're more abrupt. But I think that there are glimmers of hope here, I hope. First of all, some potential glimmers of hope is you could have state leadership on this, some state governors. And I know you need a national policy because air doesn't stay within, you know, state boundaries. But there is opportunity for states to build a coalition. And also, I think the young people, climate change is subtle science for young people, right? And so the hope is that they don't disagree on the science. And the hope is that their energy will be put into getting us back on track on this issue. And the other thing I think is important, at the very end of the story we read, they talked about the proposal. So the EPA has to put its draft proposal in the Federal Register. And then there's a 45-day comment period. Opportunity for the public to comment. So everybody listening, if you're concerned about this, there's opportunity for public input, and then there will be litigation.
There's no doubt in my mind that renewable energy is the future, globally and in the United States. It's in our interest to be investing in renewables. So there's no doubt in my mind, despite the fact that the Trump administration is working tirelessly, and the Heritage Foundation and all the things we've talked about, is working tirelessly to make it the hill harder to climb for the renewable industry. That said, there's no doubt in my mind that 20, 30, 40, when my daughter is my age, renewable energy will be the centerpiece of the of that moment. So the question is, though, Teresa, and I'm inspired by you. You tend to ask this question a lot, which is, how does the renewable industry plan for a time, this moment, that may in fact end up with a new president in 3.5 years that will reverse all of these things, and the EPA is back in the business of regulating clean air and clean water. The planning that goes on, we end up, from a competitive standpoint, we end up losing ground by this pause,
right,
when if you believe, as I do, that renewables are the future.
Right.
This pause is going to have ramifications for us in terms of competition across the globe in ways that I think we don't even fathom at the moment.
Well, I think most poignantly in the solar industry, because the Biden administration had done a good job of trying to reshore the manufacturing of solar industry, right? Because Again, I've said this before, technology that was developed here, we lost the manufacturing to China. We need to reshore it. There's a lot of incentives to do so, and a lot of those incentives have been pulled away. But again, that doesn't mean that states are abandoning. And look at New York State, Doreen Harris and head of NYSERDA. They're not, and Governor Hochul, they made clear they're not abandoning the solar wind. I mean, Trump on wind this weekend, because there's a windmill near his golf course in Scotland, and he doesn't like to look out and see the windmill. He's like, fixated about how much he hates
the
wind.
To put some more windmills.
I know, but I do think that the cost is too high. The human cost, the health cost, immigration cost. The people know that the cost is too high to ignore this. And even though there's not federal leadership, that doesn't mean there can't be state innovation, private innovation.
And that's where I think the governor has shown a lot of leadership, and certainly Letitia James, has shown an awful lot of leadership, because we may have to, as a state, to protect our own health, sue places like Ohio, who are not who don't care about clean air, because when they're polluting, all it's doing is blowing over here, mm-hmm. and this is where as a country we need. You know, this is where the federal government, this is why we have a federal government, is supposedly to work through these challenges. You know, I say this only sardonically, but I do question. I think it's really important, Bo, that people call. I really do. Okay. But the cynical side of me says, how many Americans need to call to counterweight the call from a Peter Thiel or one of the other billionaires? And right now, I think one of the things that really is aggravating me is the power of the oligarchy, I'm really angry at it.
And if people aren't, people need to pay attention to Peter Thiel and other key tech people and what they're doing with amassing information, and anyway, that's a whole separate thing.
Public funding of campaigns. The reality is, if you have public funding of campaigns, you don't have the Elon Musk and the Peter Thiels of the world who are absolutely moving the needle on election results.
And the people can also make decisions based on their own purchases, right? They can buy electric stoves. They can buy, the incentives are gone now, but you can buy electric stoves. You can buy hybrid or electric cars. You can invest in these things. We talked about it a bit on break, but this broad attack by the Trump administration on our universities, which is mind-boggling to me. But the universities need not quit on the research on climate change, and the Bloombergs of the world, those key people who have made investments, they can continue to make investments in the philanthropic sector.
Don't get me going Harvard now cutting a deal. I was so hopeful that Harvard would hold out, but they're cutting a deal.
We're actually out of time.
Nope. Darn.
Sorry,
guys. We have to end on some happy note. Is there something happy? It is Cheesecake
National
Day.
National Cheesecake Day.
It's tomatoes are in season. My tomatoes are ripe.
Fresh nice. Cucumbers, nice. Too.
There you go.
I got some fresh cucumbers as a gift the other day. Nothing better. Okay, be happy, folks.
Your panelists this morning, Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Public Policy and Communications Expert Teresa Bourgeois, and Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at UAlbany, Bob Griffin. Thank you all, as ever, for your participation. The roundtable will return after this.